Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning. I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer. This week, Getty Images and Lean In released a new collaboration. It's a collection of curated stock photography images that modernize the lens on working women. At the end of the show, I'll talk with Lean In's editor about the project, and just for fun, we're inviting you to send in your own personal photo that you think represents updated, modern, real working womanhood. No babies in briefcases, please. Use the hashtag NotYourStockWoman on Instagram or Twitter, and we'll see what we get. And we'll call in at the end of the show. We'll talk about the stock images, about what makes us roll our eyes, about what we see out there, and hear what Lean In and Getty think might be more inspiring and truthful. Also today, the second in our series of conversations with Oscar-nominated documentary filmmakers. I'll talk with the director and cinematographer of The Square. Plus, Gladys Carrión, the new commissioner of the Administration for Children's Services in New York City, talks about her new role in the de Blasio administration. And a new book about changes that emerging technologies will bring to America's economy in the future. You're feeling it right now, but we'll talk about the business models to come. But first, Republican Speaker John Boehner folded yesterday, clearing the way dramatically for an increase in the debt limit in Washington. Was it the specter of the midterm elections that changed his mind? Was it the threat of a snowstorm? Was it a lesson learned from the government shutdown in October? And a break from the pattern of demanding spending cuts in exchange for raising the debt ceiling, a rule that Boehner named after himself, by the way, the House of Representatives voted to avoid the threat of default, at least until March of next year. Well, really, the vote was mostly Democrats, but still. Joining me now to talk about this unusual vote and some more about Washington headlines is Elizabeth Williamson, national reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Anna. It's great to be with you.
Let's start by listening to Speaker Boehner yesterday describing his position.
So, President driving up the debt, and the President wanting to do nothing about the debt that's occurring, will not engage in our long-term spending problem. And so let his party give him the debt ceiling increase that he wants.
Boehner there saying let his party give him the debt ceiling increase that he wants. Of course, that was largely up to him and how that vote was structured. So this was a super partisan vote. Only 28 Republicans voted yes to the increase of the debt ceiling. Only two Democrats voted no on Boehner's so-called clean bill. Just remind us, what is a clean bill?
Well, the clean bill, and, you know, just going back to that vote, 221 to 201, is, you know, all he needed was to get a couple of his folks on board, but 199 of them said no to this. Not surprising, given all the fighting that's been going on for 3 years over this. But a clean bill would be none of the provisions, no strings attached, basically. That raise the debt ceiling without tying it to things that have been done in the past, such as rolling back significant portions of the Affordable Care Act or demanding pay-fors in the form of cutting programs in order to make up for the amount that the debt ceiling was increased. All of that went off the table, and they just decided to vote. This is, by the way, the latest in a series of votes that have been surprisingly without rancor here in the Capitol, where we've gotten used to rancor in every vote, no matter how small.
So what did you make of Boehner's announcement yesterday? I mean, was it a surprise to congressional watchers?
I think that what happened here was, you know, that he's got his eyes on the midterm elections. What happened earlier this year, as we all pretty much know, is that, you know, the Republicans got complete egg on their face when they forced a government shutdown. Their approval rating went into the single digits and into the basement. And they were, quote unquote, saved politically only by the botched rollout of the Affordable Care Act. They want to preserve the gains that they made, keep the focus on the failures of the Affordable Care Act and the difficulties in setting up and maintaining the websites and the enrollments in Obamacare. They'd like to keep the focus there because they've got their eye on the 6 seats in the Senate that they need to win a majority.
They'd like to keep their focus on health care, you say, so John Boehner allows the vote while 199 Republicans get to tell their constituents, I voted against raising the debt ceiling.
Exactly. You know, those are the folks sitting in safe seats. They get to go back into their districts and say, I don't know, I'm not running the show. This is what happened with the leadership. And they can blame them. You know, it's kind of like we do in journalism. We blame our editors. So it's a sort of thing where they
not
can go
fault.
Back and say, yeah, Boehner's fault. And, you know, I voted against it. I did the right thing. So they can be reelected. And then what they can do is, you know, try and recover from the tarnishing and the sort of beating they took earlier this year when they shut down the government. They're really trying to put that in the rearview mirror and have folks forget about it. And they want to have a series of votes that they can point to and say, look, we've come round. We understand the lack of utility involved in shutting down the whole show and taking your ball and going home because you don't agree with something.
So Republicans get to blame Speaker Boehner. Speaker Boehner, as we heard, blaming Democrats and President Obama for raising the debt ceiling. But Speaker Boehner had been shopping around a vote that would have restored cuts to military pensions. So there was a deal that left something on the table that people in the military community were watching quite closely. What happened there? How should we understand that in terms of the Republican position on military spending versus spending overall?
Well, the one item or the one category in which Republicans have always favored more spending is defense. And so this was something where, you know, this is the absolute most popular, most powerful constituency in the Capitol, wounded veterans and veterans in general. And so to try and cut back on any of their programs would have been across the board unpopular among the Republican base and you know, not only Republicans, among Democrats as well. So this was always a kind of irony in the fight over the debt ceiling and reducing the deficit because most Republicans wanted to take defense spending off the table. Well, that's such an enormous portion of the federal budget that it did sort of ring a little strangely with people. So this way they're able to make a symbolic, constituent-minded move at the same time that they said they were trying to hold the line on spending.
And what does this vote mean outside of Washington? Is there a collective sigh of relief that we won't have another showdown? How did markets react? Is there some sense of security in the U.S.'s fiscal health until at least March 2015?
Yeah, I mean, this was something where I think, you know, and I'm here in Washington, alas, and not, you know, back in the Midwest where I'm from, because I'd love to talk with people and find out what they think. But I think that, you know, after the last showdown and the shutdown, people were so disgusted with Congress that these guys just figured we can't win by doing this. Yeah, we could stand on principle, but we would affect some Tea Party members who really have nowhere else to go. In a funny way, it's kind of like what the president does with liberal groups. You know, he figures, okay, I'm going to do what I can for them, but at the same time, on things like gay marriage and some of the, you know, the things that are most precious to them, immigration. But at the same time, those constituencies are loyal to the party that they are attached to and affiliated with, and so they have nowhere else to go. So it's not like you're going to get Tea Party members defect to the Democrats because they didn't get what they wanted on spending. So it's a calculated risk. But, you know, generally speaking, it feels like they did the right thing. You know, the last few votes on presidential appointments and, you know, some of the backing down that they've done is not so much backing down as keeping their powder dry for the midterms.
Listeners, you heard Elizabeth Williamson say she wished she was back home in the Midwest to hear what folks were thinking about this vote. We want to hear your take on it. What's your reaction to the House vote raising the debt ceiling yesterday? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Our phone lines are open, whether you're applauding Boehner's move on this or hoping that Republicans in the Senate can stop this. Tell us what you're thinking. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. 800-259-9292. While those calls come in, Elizabeth, you mentioned that Tea Party lawmakers have nowhere else to go. But, of course, mm-hmm. I've seen some descriptions of this moment as an end to the period of Tea Party rule.
Unless they want to secede entirely, which isn't, you know, necessarily out of the question for many.
So there's that option.
I'm picturing a few people listening to me getting hopping mad about what I just said.
Is it overstating it to say that this is a signal that the Tea Party, you know, lawmakers have lost the ability to keep Boehner aligned with them?
I think it might be overstating it. And, you know, the reason I say that is because we'll see what happens after the midterms. You know, if the Republicans make some gains based on Americans' dissatisfaction with Obamacare and the way that was rolled out, then I think he might find that he has renewed problems with the most conservative elements in the party. At the same time, there was an interesting, and I'd love to give credit to whoever wrote it, but I just can't recall. But there was an interesting account of how he met with the party a day or two before this vote and said, "Look, this is how it's going to be." And there was utter silence in the room. So it wasn't like people sort of raised their hands and said, "I get it. I'm with you. We'll be behind you." And those 199 no votes tell you the tale. So they've agreed. They've seen the reason in putting a lid on it for now. It didn't help any of them. Although, again, the problem here is that the dissidents in the party are from very, very safe redistricted seats. And so they're not really responsible to the broader public. They're responsible to their constituents, and, you know, they won't depart. So they can vote no as long as there are enough votes to get Boehner the sort of conciliatory move that he wants. But once that majority strengthens, particularly in the Senate, if that were to happen in November, then you'd have, you know, a whole different picture. And I think you'd be in a situation where he may be once more in danger of losing control of those folks.
Depending on what happens in November. I think the account you were talking about Boehner's meeting with Republicans was in the Washington Post, and it quotes Boehner saying to a group of Republicans, "I'm getting this monkey off your back and you're not even going to clap." And he said it with sort of a slight smile, the Washington Post reported, and then there was a polite golf clap in the crowd.
Right. Yeah, that's a great account. I love that story. And so, thanks for giving them a shout out, because it really gives you a lot in, you know, what the behind the scenes dealings actually are. It's not so much a capitulation as a, you know, as you put it, you know, taking a monkey off their backs.
So is Boehner somebody that Republicans want to avoid being in a photograph with, despite getting the monkey off their back at this point?
You know, I don't see a lot of them seeking out photo ops with anybody in their own or certainly in the Democratic leadership. In that sense, they are like Democrats, who those who are in unsafe seats are not clamoring for their grip and grin with Obama either. So, you know, it's kind of it's an interesting situation where people in both parties are, you know, they're really running on their own individual records if they are at all contested, or even if they're safe. You know, they have to kind of follow the wishes of their own voters. And, you know, the leadership in general on both sides is not very popular at the moment.
Huh. Unsafe incumbents don't want to be in pictures with other incumbents.
No. They want to stick to constituents. That's really where it's at for them.
We're getting some calls. Frank in Chester, New Jersey. What do you think about this news out of Washington on the debt vote?
Well, I tell you, the news out of Washington is predictable. He didn't have the votes to take care of the day. But what's really more depressing for me is the fact that the news is you guys are very gleeful that this has occurred. You can see it, hear it in your voices. The fact is, we have to deal with this debt. And if we don't start, and if the media doesn't start talking about the debt, no matter what's under Obama's watch, Bush's watch, doesn't make any difference, right? We as a country are going to pay a terrible price. So him trying to extract some sort of a debt reduction from the president and losing was not a win for the Democrats or for this country. It was really a loss.
Frank, thanks for your call. And Elizabeth, that's a point that Speaker Boehner made. I mean, he basically called mm-hmm. this a lost opportunity, that we could have come together and come up with a real long-term plan to deal with debt in the U.S., and it's a failure that hasn't been able to happen.
Yeah, and it bears recalling, you know, that the whole idea of pay-fors and offsets for any increase in the budget is an ideal that Democrats themselves have championed, and so that's true. What's also true, though, is as the economy improves, the deficit by itself is declining. And so this is a less potent weapon than when it was at all-time highs and we were trying to, you know, swim, struggle, and drown our way out of the crisis that began in 2008. You know, the talk of the national deficit, to those who kind of really follow where it stands and how much it's grown and how much it's decreasing, has lost a little bit of heft. You know, it's really lost some power because, I mean, the good news is that the economy, albeit slowly, is improving, and that lifts all boats. So, you know, the more people employed, the more taxes that are coming in, the improvement in the housing market, more property taxes coming into municipal governments and states, this is all starting to affect the big number of the deficit, and that's positive. So, you know, at the same time, you can't use that as a sort of banner to rally under as effectively as Republicans could, in particular, could do, and some Democrats even 4 years ago.
We will continue, however, to hear about the national debt and when the Senate votes, which is expected today, which brings us to Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, who's got a thread up his sleeve. What is he saying?
Ted Cruz is about Ted Cruz, and he is like a classic example of one of those lawmakers who has an extraordinarily safe seat because he is a senator, so he's not coming from a district that's at all contested. He's in Texas, and so, you know, he's about Ted Cruz. You know, he really wants to make a name for himself. He doesn't have the midterms in mind, by the way. He's got 2016 in mind. So for him to grandstand only increases his visibility and has made him a real champion among Tea Party Republicans.
He said yesterday he would object to any vote to raise the debt ceiling with a minimum of 51 votes in the Senate. He said he wants to require 60 votes.
Yeah.
Is he in position again to stall Senate business as he's done before?
It would be fascinating if he were to do this, because one could argue that he would raise his personal profile among those most likely to vote for him by doing so. At the same time, there was so much derision heaped on him, even from those in his own party, after his gigantic filibuster during the shutdown, that it would be an extraordinarily risky political maneuver for him to do so. But if you look at his history, he doesn't always care about that kind of thing. You know, when he served in the Bush White House, he was basically drummed out for being his own man and being a maverick and not really playing ball with the rest of his peers. So we'll see. I mean, it's almost as much a psychological question as it is a political one.
Many political questions in 2014, this year of midterm elections. And you said earlier that getting this vote out of the way on the House side in many ways cleared the deck for talking points to talk about Obamacare and health care and the rollout. Let's talk about the delay in the mandate for employers, a further delay that was announced this week. Tell us about that and who it will affect.
Sure. This delay affects, and, you know, it's as we know, it's the latest in many. But this concerns employers with 50 to 99 full-time workers. They won't have to, before, they were required to provide insurance by next year to those employees or pay a fee. But now that's been delayed for an additional year. And beyond that, companies that have more workers than 99 can also avoid some penalties in 2015, next year, if they show that they're covering at least 70% of their full-time workers. Now, in some senses, this is, again, strategic on the part of the administration and of Democrats, because you have people who are losing their jobs because they work more than 29 hours a week, and so that's the threshold under which an employer has to provide coverage for them. So what they're basically doing is taking their hours from 30 down to 29, from, you know, down to 25, so that they don't have to be covered. So this is also a move aimed at countering or bringing up the employment in the United States, but at the same time, it really looks for all the world to most people like another tweak and adjustment that's required in this law that is, you know, been problematic for this entire year.
And as far as estimates for how many workers that actually covers, do you, any sense on the numbers?
I don't really, you know. It says that that these new rules for the 50 to 99 workers would cover about 2% of all U.S. businesses and 7% of workers. So that comes out to about 8 million people. So that's significant. And then the rules for the companies with 100 or more, where they would have to cover at least 70% of their workers, that affects an additional 2%. But that's like 74 million people. So it's pretty significant, and it's something that if it were, I think what they're trying to do here is to tack a little bit so that, say they did roll this out, they began implementing the penalties, they were requiring this coverage, and they again had some kind of problem in enforcing this, by moving it off, then they're not having to deal with any kind of implementation problems at a time when they've already got plenty of those.
So they're delaying the political consequences, but are they also working on that rollout in the meantime?
Yes, absolutely. They're trying to clean, you know, sort of fix the bugs, iron out bugs in the rollout and in the enforcement mechanisms. At the same time, they move this off and put it, you know, in a move it off and postpone it so that it better coincides with the political calendar and keeps them out of hot water. I mean, what the administration wants most of all is to fix the problems that exist and just have things be calm, keep this program out of the headlines for a year or two, because that's going to significantly impact their fortunes, not only in the Senate in 2014, but in 2016.
So a lot of talk about positioning ahead of political calendars, but I also, before you go, want to ask you about your reports on Fed Chairwoman Janet Yellen's testimony yesterday. She gave 6.5 hours of testimony before the House Financial Services Committee. It was her first time in that position. You wrote that she was, quote, as determined, exacting, and endlessly boring as she planned. What did you mean by that?
Her primary goal, and it was striking from the minute she entered the room, and, you know, I took a little grief for describing, you know, the sort of somber, sensible clothes she was wearing, but that is exactly what she was trying to project with every fiber of herself yesterday and in every word of her message. She wanted to say, this is a change in leadership at the Fed, but it is not a discontinuation of policy. We're tapering back our investment in the markets to try and calm things down, but we're not making any radical moves. And, you know, the markets responded. You know, the stock market had a really good day yesterday, and people were assuaged. You know, they felt like she's a reassuring figure. She's obviously firmly in control. She's brilliant. She'll continue her predecessor's policies, and there's no reason to think she's going to do anything radical or, as I put it in that piece, colorful, which, you know, the markets don't want color. They want predictability, and that's what she was projecting yesterday.
It's interesting. I mean, so much talk about translating what Alan Greenspan was saying when he wasn't speaking clearly, and you were looking to Janet Yellen's sensible shoes for some kind of symbolism about the economy.
And, you know, and the fact that she flat out said, I believe that I'm a sensible central banker. You know, she also was remarkable in that she was a straight shooter. Bernanke and Greenspan could be somewhat obfuscatory in the way they presented information. They kept people guessing. People would sort of read tea leaves to try and understand what they were saying. She was straight out there. You could also see her concern about unemployment and her idea that, you know, it was unusual for a central banker to go so deeply into the issue of employment and unemployment and the impact on the economy. And she talked about how long-term unemployment created a significant drag on the economy. I mean, she went more into the policy arena than many central bankers often do. They kind of like to stay behind the curtain of Oz, if you will. But this time she came right out, and she was even prescriptive at times in talking with Congress about what they could do to spur unemployment and thereby, you know, improve the economy and get us out of this for keeps.
And just generally, how would you characterize? I mean, she talked about the effects of long-term unemployment. She talked. Mm-hmm. She gave some recommendations to Congress. How does she feel we're doing in the U.S. economy right now?
Her message was very reassuring in that, okay, it's, you know, what we've all been hearing often lately, you know, the recovery is slow, but it's happening. And, you know, as long as we keep seeing these signs in unemployment, in inflation, in the housing market, we're going to stay the course. We'll continue to taper our, you know, the Fed's involvement in the markets and its purchases of Treasury securities. But at the same time, you know, that she would keep a close eye on things. And if there was a significant, and she used that word, you know, it has to be a significant deterioration in the market, would they divert from the course they've set? That's a really reassuring message. And it's a comforting message to not only market players, but to Americans who have really been through hell over the last 4 years.
So Janet Yellen's message, we're steadily staying the course while vulnerable lawmakers don't want to be in pictures with the status quo whatsoever. That's where we are in America today.
Yeah, exactly. You know, on the economic side, the status quo, you know, is improving. So, yeah, it's Yellen herself is just a reassuring figure. She's been part of the Fed for a couple of decades, and she's personally brilliant. So, you know, this idea that, you know, as the first female chairman of the Fed, she cuts quite a figure, and you know, she's really impressive, and she was extraordinarily reassuring yesterday.
Elizabeth Williamson with The Wall Street Journal, thank you so much for joining us and giving us the vantage point from Washington, D.C.
Anna, it was a pleasure.
Coming up, I'll talk to New York City's new commissioner for the Administration for Children's Services, Gladys Carione. We'll also take your calls. I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer.